chapter 83, page 114. Also, Khatib Khwarizmi has quoted this narration in Al-Manaqib, page 313, and Juwayni in Fara'id al-Simtayn, volume 1, page 320. In another occasion, we see that at the time of the third caliph, there was a meeting by the companions of the Prophet, different Muhajirin and Ansar, and each one of them was talking about his virtues. Imam Ali Salam remained silent. When all people talked about their virtues, they asked Imam Ali Salam also to talk about his virtues. And in one part of his sermon or speech, Imam Ali Salam again referred to Ayatul Wilaya and قال فأنشدكم بالله أتعلمون حيث نزلت الذين آمنوا الذين يقيمون الصلاة ويؤتون الزكاة وهم راكعون قال الناس يا رسول الله أخاصة في بعض المؤمنين أم عامة لجميعهم. Imam Ali Salam says that, you know, that when this verse was revealed, the companions of the Prophet asked the Prophet that, is it a general verse or is it khasa? It is for
special for a person. Yes.
Exactly. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala asked the Prophet, commanded him to explain this verse to the people, to tell the people that no, it's not a verse for all the people. It is absolutely exclusive. And for that, the Prophet explained the issue in Ghadir Khum.
Okay.
So again, another narration in which Imam alayhi salam very explicitly is referring to his wilaya and caliphate after the Prophet. This is in Al-Ihtijaj by Tabrisi, volume 1, page 147.
Okay.
In another occasion, it's been mentioned by Ibn Abil Hadid, the famous Sunni scholar, that in one occasion, a man told Imam Ali Salam, accused Imam Ali Salam as a man looking for power and caliphate. Some people claim that it was Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, and others believe that it was Abu Ubaidah Jarrah. Now, answering him, Imam Ali Salam says, بل أنتم والله لأحرص وأبعد وأنا أخص وأقرب. I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that you are looking for power. You are against the Prophet. You are away from the Prophet, and I am the closest one to the Prophet. وإنما طلبت حقا لي. If I'm looking for something, I'm looking for my right. حقا لي. وأنتم تحولون بيني وبينه. You are the people who are preventing me from my right. That is the caliphate of the Prophet. This is mentioned in one of the sermons of Nahj al-Balagha. In another occasion, Imam Ali salam is quoted as saying, Allahumma inni asa'dika ala Quraysh wa man a'anahum. O Allah, I complain to you against Quraysh and all the people who helped them. Because one of the crimes that Imam Ali salam mentions for Quraysh is that وَأَجْمَعُ عَلَى مُنَازَعَةِ أَمْرًا هُوَ لِي. All of them, they came together to usurp a right which was only belonging to me. In another occasion, Imam Ali al-Salam says, فَوَاللَّهِ I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that مَا زِلْتُ مَدْفُوعًا عَنْ حَقِّي مُسْتَأْثَرًا عَلَيَّ مُنْذُ قَبَضَ اللَّهُ نَبِيَّهُ حَتَّى يَوْمَ النَّاسِ هَذَا. I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that from the time, from the day that the Holy Prophet passed away, my right has been usurped from me. So all these cases, in all these cases, Imam Ali Salam is proving explicitly his right to, immediate caliphate and successorship after the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family. And some of them are mentioned in Nahj al-Balagha as well. If I have time, there is a letter in which Imam Ali Salam sends to the people of Egypt. And in it, he explains the issue, why he didn't even, fight for, gaining his right.
Shall we get to this letter and the other occasions in the next program?
Sure, inshallah.
Okay, because it is a very good topic. But all in all, as you said, Imam Ali alayhi salam in most cases referred to the text of the Holy Quran
mm-hmm.
in order to prove his own right of caliphate and imamate. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration. We'll continue our discussion on Imam Ali alayhi salam's right of power and Imamat in his own words in upcoming session of the program. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
Thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min labani Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في علي وحسين وحسن.
The story of domestic violence in the United States. The slogans in these placards are a protest to the law and the US government's indifference towards the demands of the American women during the 60s and 70s. Indifference towards women's rights to education, equal pay, suitable jobs, respect and social rights, and most of all, protection against domestic violence. Of course, perhaps these women's anger was more towards the laws that did not have their back rather than their husbands. Women who were beaten at home by their husbands for different reasons, yet the law only supported them up until the door of their house. The law's excuse for this was not to intervene in the citizens' private affairs. Thus, when it came to the house, it was the men who made the law. The battered women would cover up their bruised faces with makeup, and there weren't many who were much inclined to speak about the things that happened to them inside the house.
Okay, let's hold my arm.
The men, on the other hand, did not shy away from violence towards their wives due to the free pass the culture and law gave them in this regard. The women of America demanded rights to education, payment, and security.
Equal rights to set forth our own humanity, equal rights to get into graduate programs, to get into schools, to training programs. We're the bottom third of the employment in terms of pay. We represent nonetheless 34% of the workforce, yet we're the first to be laid off and the last to be hired. There aren't frivolous demands at all. We just want what men have had all these years.
This issue did not belong to past centuries. This is the United States of America of 1970. Although protests against domestic violence intensified during the second half of 1970, husbands abusing their wives and justifying their actions had roots in times as far as the first American immigrants who settled in those lands. When the first immigrants arrived in this region, they started to write laws for their newly founded America by forming a government. The first settlers of America took their law from the common law derived from the traditional rules of the British judicial system. Common law originated in England in the Middle Ages and was applied in British colonies across the continents. According to this law, a man had the right to punish his wife if needed. In 1982, an important event took place that marked the beginning of a review in the issue of domestic violence against women. Tracy Thurman, a housewife in the city of Torrington. First, in October 1982, Charles, Thurman's husband, had a fight with her and threw her out of the house. Tracy went to the police department, but the police did not handle her case because there was no law to support her. A month later, it happened again. This time, Charles, Tracy's husband, broke the car window on her while she was sitting in the car. Tracy's body was covered with broken glass. This time, because the crime happened outside the house, the police got involved, and the court issued a restraining order against Charles for 2 years. However, during this period of 2 years, Charles repeatedly violated the court's order, and each time Tracy's complaint did not result in anything. Charles even threatened to kill her once, but the police did not do anything about it. A few months later, when Tracy was at home with her child, her husband Charles entered their residence. Tracy called the police. Charles stabbed Tracy's neck, throat, and chest with a knife. At this moment, a police officer arrived, but Charles, without fear, kicked Tracy in the head with another hard blow. Tracy was now lying on the ground in her own blood, but the police still did not react. Charles was about to attack Tracy, who was sleeping on the stretcher of the emergency team. But this time, the police stopped watching and finally arrested Charles after he had inflicted multiple stabbings and hittings to Tracy's head several times. Tracy Thurman spent 8 months in the hospital. Some of her body parts were temporarily and others permanently paralyzed. This time, instead of suing her husband, Tracy sued the police department for not supporting and defending her. Now, women's slogans had become more uniform and coherent. Women unite. Don't let racism divide us. Girls are powerful. The rise of women's protests against men's violence, along with the liberal slogans, marked yet another event. Feminist movements were gradually born, and protests against the inferior status of women and the violence they endured at home began in the American society. American states, one by one, began to repeal the laws that allowed men to punish women. The U.S. government, maintaining that a man's home is his castle, had traditionally been reluctant to police the confines of the home. Moreover, many legal authorities insisted on blaming the victim and believed that the wife was partially responsible for her beating by provoking her husband and making him angry. American laws allowed a man to punish a woman under the pretext of reforming her. The courts only considered the complaint of a beaten woman if the woman was severely injured during the beating by her husband. However, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was approved by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris on December 10, 1948, said something else. Article 1 of the Declaration. All human beings are born free and are equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood.
Approved by an overwhelming majority. The Declaration of Human Rights as a standard of conduct for all. And let us, as members of the United Nations, conscious of our own shortcomings and imperfections, join our effort in good faith to live up to this high standard. Thank you.
But women were still deprived of such a right in America. Violence against women was considered normal. This normality can be understood in a joke that was broadcast on the BBC radio in the same years. A woman asks another why she feels her husband doesn't love her anymore. She hears the answer, "He hasn't beaten me in a week or two." Little by little, various organizations started to deal with the domestic violence against women under the title of non-governmental organizations. The law changed, but the culture of violence against women still carries on. The slogan of gender equality gradually made women own rights that might have been funny to think about in the United States a few decades ago. In addition to the right to vote and the right to employment and equal wages, they now had the right to wear clothes. They could decide for the life or death of the fetus inside their womb, or they could even have other kinds of freedom in sexual issues. But did helpless women really join feminism movements to achieve such freedoms? Apparently, everything has benefited women, but there is still a problem. Women were still beaten by men. Liberalism. It reinforced racism, classism, and other forms of oppression. Women were now oppressed again, but this time this oppression was not only from their husbands. Every man who had the chance to communicate with that woman would provide the basis for this, with sexual harassment and physical violence. These are official statistics from within the United States. Every year, about 500,000 people in America are victims of sexual violence, including 12-year-old children. However, 90% of the people who were raped are adult women. 2022. According to statistics, one out of every three women in the United States has experienced violence from her husband or partner. About 20,000 calls are made to the domestic violence help centers every day. And on the other end of the line are people who have been beaten or threatened with death by their spouses or partners. The phenomenon of violence against women in the United States may not be at the top of the world news like that of third world countries, but this does not mean that violence against women does not exist in the States. According to statistics from the National Office on Domestic Violence, one woman is battered every 9 seconds in the United States. Florida State Senator Janet Cruz's report is worth considering.
In Florida, there were 106,000 reported domestic violence offenses in 2020. And that was including more than 200 domestic violence murders.
This log home at Big Lake was one of Bree Moore's favorite places.
Her formal name is Brianna, but as she got older, she wanted to be called Bree.
Her parents say they can still feel her presence here.
She would get me up early in the morning and say, "Dad, come on, we've got to go. We've got to go ride." She made every minute out of her life special.
Police told the Moores their daughter's body was found at her boyfriend's home, where he lived with his parents. The Moores asked if there had been a home invasion.
They said no. They said Josh, her boyfriend, killed her.
Bree would be the last. Years later, what really was happening with Josh and his history, this was really the inevitable.
But at the time, Bree seemed so devoted to her boyfriend, busy at her job as an aide in a dentist's office. But behind her smile, Bree's coworkers saw signs of trouble, signs they didn't reveal to the Moores until after her death.
They told me that she had come in several times with black eyes, and one time she came in and she hadn't just been hit, they said she had been beaten. And she couldn't function, and she vomited in the sink, and she left after about 15 minutes they sent her home.
There were other red flags.
Well, I'll read you a text message that we found on Bree's phone after we got her phone back 2.5 years after she was killed. Bree texts, "You better love me and stop hitting me, please," with an exclamation point. "Josh, of course I love you, and Ramrod hit you, not I." So Ramrod must have been, you know, when he got angry, I'm assuming.
Nadine M. Neufoil, director of the Department of Violence Against Women at the U.S. Department of Justice, says, "Based on our findings in the United States, every day, 3 women in this country are murdered by their spouse or ex-partner. This statistic is very alarming for us." Nadine M. Neufoil's story is not the story of primitive African tribes or so-called third world countries. This is the United States of America in the year 2022. The 21st century, the cradle of freedom and democracy.
Because Brandy's case reminded Guard of Anitra Coburn.
Carter kidnapped Anitra and eventually took her to her grandparents' trailer in Franklin County.
Coburn's boyfriend kidnapped her from her Pitt County home and murdered her after holding her hostage for a week.
Half a century has passed since the protests of American women in 1970. And now, domestic violence has the voice of Angelina Jolie, a Hollywood star who was also once a victim.
Most of all, I want to acknowledge the children who are terrified and suffering at this moment, and the many people for whom this legislation comes too late.
A bipartisan group of U.S. senators has introduced a proposal to reauthorize a 1990s law that expands protections for victims of domestic and sexual violence. This law was dissolved in 2019 due to the opposition of Republicans, which has led to the promotion and increase of violence and murder in American society. Angelina Jolie asks U.S. senators to approve this law and says, "I repeat, this is one of the most important votes you will cast in the Senate this year." When silence comes from a Congress too busy to renew the Violence Against Women Act after a decade, it reinforces that sense of worthlessness. It's clear that the indifference of the Congress and the American government has troubled the 47-year-old Oscar winner. This was the third time that Angelina asked the representatives of the U.S. Congress to revise the law to control domestic violence. This law was first sent to the Senate in 1990 by Joe Biden, who was then a senator, with the aim of reducing domestic and sexual violence. A later version was included in a bill signed by then-President Bill Clinton 4 years later. Congress has since reauthorized and extended the Violence Against Women Act 3 times.
Senator Joe Biden invited them to speak.
Battered women need to be taken seriously. Proper police response can prevent what happened to me from happening to someone else. Thank you.
Thank you.
The story of domestic violence in the United States and the law to deal with it is a paraphrase of the saying, "The law often shows its teeth, but does not bite." The United States has moved away from the slogan of creating equal conditions and ideal and happy life for women. In a way, This shows America cannot be a good model for other societies. Feminist slogans try to make women equal to men in all matters. For example, the society should witness that women are beaten less. But why did feminism and women's movements target the family to achieve this goal? It was already known that a woman without a family would be disarmed. And that's how it happened. In practice, women still did not get their real rights. Until yesterday, they were under male violence at home. But today, they are under the domination of employers and cheap forces. They are now also responsible for financing themselves, a task that, at least in the distant years, was the responsibility of men. A century has passed from the American women's efforts to escape domestic violence and achieve equality. Yet domestic violence still takes 3 victims every day. Families are broken. Women are employed in menial jobs. And the salary and benefit system still consider women as second-hand labor. Kindergartens have expanded, but next to girls' high schools, right beside unmarried mothers. Joni Ernst, a Republican senator, is also a victim of sexual and domestic violence. We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. How the blockaded Gaza Strip looks like and how its residents deal with the hardships in the besieged area is hard to describe. Every day is a new tragic story which the Zionist regime has imposed on innocent Palestinians. However, the fabricated regime of Israel is getting close to its end. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "This past August, Ahmad Amir, 34, stood atop the wreckage of a residential building in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. In the scorching sun, he smashed giant blocks of rubble with his hammer, breaking them into smaller pieces and loading them onto the back of a truck. Amir works for a construction company that recycles the debris and rubble left behind by Zionist regime attacks on Gaza, a business that shows no sign of letting up. The Zionist regime's 3-day attack at the beginning of August 2022 killed at least 49 Palestinians and destroyed or damaged 2,000 homes throughout Gaza, including the building that Amir was scavenging on behalf of his employers. I'm conflicted between being glad that I got a job and upset that it came at a cost of other people losing their houses, Amir said. Amir had been unemployed for more than 5 years before getting this job in May 2021, shortly after another Israeli regime attack on the Gaza Strip destroyed over 2,200 homes. Before, Amir said, I hardly ever got work and had to borrow money from my relatives to support my family at subsistence level. Now he works 12 hours a day for $15. The company he works for, he said, employs its workers on a short-term contract basis and doesn't provide them with health insurance even though the job itself is quite dangerous. There is the ever-present risk of a structural collapse since the buildings have not been completely leveled. At the least, falling debris can land workers in the hospital with a broken leg or arm. Amir believes the whole business is a cruel trick of fate. It does not seem just that one of the few sources of employment for residents of Gaza, with its 44% rate of unemployment, is among its ruins. According to Naji Sarhan of Gaza's Public Works and Housing Ministry, Gaza's rubble scavenging business dates back to the time of Operation Cast Lead. Taking place in late 2008 and early 2009, Cast Lead began a series of major Zionist regime attacks. During it, the fabricated regime of Israel destroyed or damaged over 11,000 housing units. Amid this destruction, the Gaza authorities devised a plan to reuse debris from destroyed buildings, said Sarhan. This reuse was essential since the Zionist regime has banned imports of so-called dual-use materials, which includes many building supplies as part of its 15-year blockade on Gaza. And despite the Gaza reconstruction mechanism, an arrangement overseen by Israeli regime that is supposedly intended to facilitate reconstruction, reconstruction has been proceeding slowly. All the debris that Amir collects will be transported to a crusher and then reconstituted into concrete blocks for reconstruction efforts or new building projects. Meanwhile, workers like Mohammad Medouch, 25, scavenge for another valuable building component, iron. Medouch lost his job at a garment factory in 2012 and has worked in the rubble salvage business since the summer of 2014, when the Zionist regime launched yet another major attack on Gaza. Despite sustaining multiple work injuries from falling debris, such as leg and arm fractures, he could not afford to take time off, he said. I had no alternative but to accept this position. Anything is better than nothing in Gaza. Debris is also turning into a profitable business for some. Mohammed Abu Jabbar, 48, who runs numerous construction ventures, quickly adapted to the new economic environment and shifted his business focus on recycled rubble. He said, necessity is the mother of invention, stating that with so many Zionist regime's restrictions on construction supplies, there were severe shortages of cement and iron. As a result, in recent years, his cement block factory had decreased production by around 70% due to the Zionist regime's blockade. With the recycling of debris, his factory's production has seen an increase in production by 30% following the most recent assaults in 2021 and 2022. Abu Jabbar said that the Zionist regime tries to hinder the recycling process because they don't want our factories to operate and the city to be rebuilt. He said that the Zionist regime had even added stone crushers to the list of banned import items, but that his company made local crushers out of used equipment and created roughly 20 tons of concrete per day. In addition to providing employment opportunities, recycled building materials are also cheaper. Abu Jaba said at a locally produced cinder blocks cost $22 compared to $31 for an imported block. Even with cheaper materials on offer, many Gaza neighborhoods have still not been rebuilt. Only 40% of the completely demolished residential units from Operation Cast Lead have been rebuilt, according to Sarhan. What is the real cost of recycled materials? The cost of rebuilding Gaza is not cheap. A 2021 study by the World Bank, European Union, and the UN estimated that Gaza's immediate housing reconstruction needs totaled up to $160 million. While that study downplays the Zionist regime's direct role in the destruction, it also estimates that total reconstruction before the 2022 Israeli regime attacks would cost $345 to $485 million. Sarhan estimates that reconstruction buildings and infrastructure damaged by the Zionist regime attacks in 2021 and 2022 will cost at least $500 million. But who knows what it will cost after another Israeli regime attack. He said Israel frequently attacks Gaza City. Then, after one attack, they launch another attack on the city after it has been restored. But this time, in August 2022, Israel attacked the city before we had repaired half of the structures that had been devastated in the aggression of 2021. Each time the Zionist regime attacks Gaza, the reconstruction efforts begin anew. That's why contractor Samir Saad said the demand for recycled material keeps going on in Gaza. Saad said, "Since we began recycling, many residents have chosen to utilize recycled building materials to rebuild their structures since they are half as expensive as imposed ones," he added. "I understand it is only a short-term improvement because the city won't see real growth unless building materials are freely and regularly allowed to enter the city." Even then, he said, Gaza's true rebuilding needs were far from covered.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Today we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dear listeners, Professor Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, and we have had this pleasure to have him in the studio. We, in this program, discuss your problems, questions related to the Islamic upbringing and different topics which have a very great deal with the Islamic upbringing of children. And the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad and his family, may peace be upon them. Professor Hakim, in our previous episode, we discussed that one of the things a child is not able to manage outside is conflict resolution, because he has not learned conflict management at home. So what are some conflict resolution techniques that you suggest parents can teach to their children?
Yes, as we said before, that we need to set a good example between ourselves as parents, to show them that we can, you know, we can have differences. Having differences of opinion is not a problem.
It's okay.
Everyone has a right to his own opinion. That's why we say we respect each other's opinions. We should teach our children, and first ourselves, that we can agree to disagree. That is important. So that is one point which has to be taught and understood. We should not feel bad by the fact that someone is opposing our view. Having a different opinion is not wrong, is not bad. I should not be offended with it. Yes, someone has, there's different types of opinions. Now, I mean, what are we talking about? If we're talking about ideological issues, about Islam, about religion, about things which are important, difference of opinion there, what does that entail? Does it entail that a person has an opinion against Islam?
Mm-hmm.
So that is problematic. We can't say that as parents, one parent says, I believe in God, the other parent says, I don't believe in God.
All right.
So that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about issues of everyday
lives.
Daily lives, managing daily lives, what to do and what not to do in our daily lives. That is what we're talking about. Otherwise, issues of a high-level worldview, ideology, strategic issues of life, important decisions in life. I mean, you can't say, oh, my opinion is that I need to stay at home all the time and do not work. So a man can't say that. He has to go out to work.
All right.
Or the woman says, oh, I won't do the cooking. I'm not supposed to do the cooking.
I'm not here for this.
I'm not here. I don't have any responsibility. Okay, that's a good opinion. That may be good, but that's not going to make the house run properly. So when we talk about opinions, meager issues are there. Nominal issues need to be discussed and managed. I mean, what should I wear? What should he wear? What should we eat? Should we go out? When should we go out? Daily issues. That's where problems arise. Yes, we can have debates on ideological issues. We can have debates about them. We can teach each other about those things. But a conflict of opinion which makes us go out of the realm of Islam or our worldview, that's not going to be acceptable. But everyone should be able to freely talk about it. The problem in ideological issues, worldview issues, we can't suppress people, our children. We need them to open up so that we can rectify them if they're making a mistake.
All right.
So our children should learn about the degrees of the importance of issues.
Yeah.
There are high-level issues where we can have a different opinion, but we need to reach the correct answer.
Yeah.
But then we come to tactical issues, how to manage things,
mm-hmm.
and operational issues.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about management,
yeah.
we have high-level management, strategic issues, worldview, ideology, mission statement, whatever, what we need to do with our lives. And then we have how to do things, tactics.
Exactly, yeah.
And then when to do them.
We'll discuss more on them after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned for us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. And Professor Naqavi is teaching us some of the techniques that we can teach to our children to resolve conflicts.
So we started off by saying, where do conflicts arise? We have three levels of issues. One is the strategic issues, high-level issues, ideological issues, worldviews. That's one place. Tactical issues, how to do things,
yeah.
How to manage things.
Yeah.
Strategic and strategies and tactics and techniques. And then we have the operational issues, when to go out, where to go out, who should go out, who should do that, who should do this in the house, how to manage things at the house, who's going to tidy up the place, who's going to make the wash the bathroom or whatever. So that's operational issues. So we have conflicts in these areas, in these three different areas. In the first area, the top level arguments are there. They should be freely allowed, but we need to get to the right decisions. Our children need to be taught where to make the, where's the right thing, where's the red line.
Okay.
Then tactical issues of how to do things, that's free to debate, open to debate. I mean, your children can come up with new ideas for doing how to do things.
You need to show them the things so that they can explore their talents, basically.
I mean, you need to manage things at home, time management, how to do that. Tell them to come up with ideas, how to get things done. These needs need ideas. I mean, today technology is advancing. How do we employ technology in doing things, in getting things done at home, at school, at workplace? So these are things which need to be discussed. When we open up with our children, between ourselves, we learn new things, and we are ready to learn and show them that we are ready to learn. You should also learn. So learning should also be there. So conflict management is there if we have decided upon the principles at the higher level that we want a good life, we want a pure life, we want to live a life of godliness and goodliness. We need to a life of goodness and godliness. Then we need to manage our lives using techniques and tactics which will lead us to that pure life. So yeah. We have a consensus, an agreement over basic issues. Mm-hmm. Then we come to tactical issues that is open to debate when we can come up with the best ideas. And then operational level things, when to do things, where to do things, how that can also be discussed. So we need to open up the space for free discussion and debates and manage conflicts when you are open yeah. to debates.
So there are three things that we have reached to. That first, one thing should be understood that there could be difference of opinion. You should welcome difference of opinions. Second, debates are open. And then third comes the management, how you manage those. Well, we'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we are discussing the issue of conflict management, how we can teach conflict management to our children. Professor Naqavi, we are saying that how do these kinds of kids grow in society? How do they come up in the society? Who can't face the conflicts, who can't manage them? And this is because of over-pampering. And we have children who are being pampered so much So do you think these pampering children, when they are given extreme love at home, or they are not, they are giving whatever they want right away, whenever they want it, and they are not asked about what they did with their pocket money, and they are asked so many different things, they are not being asked, and they are not being questioned, and they are being just given and given without any curious. Don't you think when they grow up and when they are married to some person, do you think here they will develop some serious issues, some serious problems, because they were pampered since their childhood, and now they get married to a person who is reasonable, sensible, and who is not someone who is going to pamper this partner all the time?
Exactly, that's a very basic issue that you have pointed out. Pampering means that there's no education, there's no upbringing. Everything is free-floating.
While many think that this pampering is actually upbringing.
No, this is allowing them to float freely in the air, not taking care of anything. I mean, you just mentioned pocket money. Now, why do we give pocket money? Why should we give pocket money? And what should be done with the pocket money? That has to be also
asked
and understood ourselves. Why should we be giving? We need to give him pocket money, not to spend it as he or she likes, as much as he likes. No, there should be
With reasons.
Yes, with reasons. Number one.
Or with alternatives that you provide to them.
Why should I give you pocket money?
Explain that.
Firstly, he or she should realize that why is he be giving pocket money? There are certain rules. It's not just because, oh, I love you, I'm your father, I'm responsible for you. Look, I'm taking care of all your needs, so why do you need pocket money? No, I need pocket money to buy things which I want. You're not giving them to me. Okay, what are those things? Let us discuss. I will give you pocket money, but it has strings attached to it. You need to do this, you need to do this. If you do this, if you study properly, if you take care of this, if you take care of a chore at home, a task at outside, I will give you pocket money. Pay.
Make it a give and take process.
Why don't you earn your pocket money?
Making them learn things.
Earn your pocket money.
Yeah.
A child needs to learn to earn. So pocket money can be given, but with certain terms. And how to spend it again should be taught.
Yeah.
What are the things in life which are important?
Yeah.
So that is everything should be a learning process for ourselves and for our children. We need to question ourselves, what are we doing? So it comes back to the strategic issues that I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Why should we be doing things? Why and what do we want to achieve in our lives, a pure life? What should we be doing to achieve that? We need to be training ourselves and educating our children. How to manage that life, that is strategy and tactics and techniques. We should be learning that. And operational daily issues, we need to learn that and teach our children to manage our lives. Otherwise, our lives will be without any flavor, without any essence. Our life will be not worthy of living.
Not colorful, yeah.
It would be a life of nothingness.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and sharing such beautiful thoughts with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.